I think we can all agree on this point. The 2016 election is one for the books. We might even agree that American electoral seasons are way too long, way too expensive. And perhaps we can agree that it's all pretty complicated. Not the candidates. I'll leave that for the historians and the psychologists to work out. The electoral procedures themselves. Most countries have one central electoral commission, one standard ballot. We, the United States, we have dozens of individual authorities, dozens of different ballots, paper, electronic, punch card, and of course the infamous Palm Beach County, Florida butterfly ballot from the 2000 election. And that's not even getting into the Electoral College, or why we vote on a workday, or the many ways in which American voters, especially minorities, have been disenfranchised through everything from gerrymandering to dirty tricks campaigns, calling people and telling them the election's on a different day, or their traffic ticket disqualifies them from being able to vote. And yet, for all the imperfections in our own system, Americans are at work around the world trying to help other countries improve their own democracies. That said,
we don't hold the West, certainly not the United States, in our work as the shining example that other countries should aspire to be like.
This is David Carroll, who heads the Democracy Program at the Carter Center in Atlanta. That's as in former President Jimmy Carter. The Carter Center has been doing election monitoring and helping strengthen democracies around the world for about three decades, and David Carroll has been part of the effort for almost that long. I traveled with the Carter Center a couple of times in China in the 1990s when I was based there as a foreign correspondent. The Carter Center was monitoring village elections, hoping this modest local-level democracy would eventually trickle up. It hasn't. The Communist Party in general, and its current leader Xi Jinping in particular, have made sure of that. But my travels with the Carter Center, and especially with the late, great Robert Pastor, who had a gift for being funny, perceptive, and persuasive, even with local Chinese officials who weren't much interested in democracy, made me think of what the Carter Center's work abroad might have to say this election season about how challenges for democracy around the globe rhyme with what's been happening here at home, and how we might learn from them to make it a whole lot better next time. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. So, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that often it's a long-form documentary. But sometimes it's just a simple interview with someone who has a lot of interesting things to say. This is one of those times. Before I get into the conversation I had with David Carroll, let me clarify that the Carter Center does not actually monitor elections in the United States. It doesn't want to be accused of bias, since the Carters are known Democrats, and Jimmy Carter's grandson, Jason Carter, now the chairman of the Carter Center, has run for governor of Georgia and probably isn't done with politics yet. So, the Carter Center focuses on helping strengthen democracies abroad. It has monitored more than 100 elections in more than 30 countries. Still, I figured David Carroll might have a personal observation or two on the state of democracy in the United States. We started our conversation with that.
I think things are changing a lot. The degree to which people are unhappy in this country is the thing that makes me most concerned. And the lack of efforts to really try to understand different points of view are the things that I find most concerning. And I guess maybe the degree to which we are unprepared from an election administration perspective to deal with difficult elections in this country.
So how did we get here?
I really don't know. You know, I think the difficulty of the 2000 election, I think, started to expose the problems in terms of our institutions and our administration of elections. But I think it's probably also just been, you know, the shift in the political parties and a sense of that people maybe start to wonder, are we all in this society and do we all have a fair share and a fair stake in this society? And different conceptions about those things, different sense of identity. You know, are we able to live our lives in a way that is meaningful to us? And I think those things are, there's very different perspectives from different parts of the country.
On the electoral process itself, when you're looking at a country, a democracy in transition, are there patterns? Are there particular types of violations or shortcuts or, you know, problems that you come across on a regular basis? And are any of them showing up here?
I mean, there's different kinds of things. There are election administration problems and the degree to which there's an election management body that really is capable and that it has the tools and the training. But that's more of the technical side. Are there good, solid democratic institutions in place that have experience and that have some kind of longevity where they really are performing as solid democratic institutions? How is the country, how is the government performing economically in particular? Is it really starting to show that when you have a democracy, it's starting to deliver for people? A whole nother level of issues is the degree to which there's social cleavages, ethnic differences, identity differences. Do those overlap with geopolitical distinctions in the country? How integrated is the population? So depending upon which of those factors come into play, we see different kinds of problems.
There's a lot of concern that the world in general is moving in the wrong direction, that there is this rise of nativism in parts of Europe and in the United States. But others make an argument that, in fact, net-net, we're still doing kind of okay in terms of the number of democracies that are emerging and then holding steady.
You know, we've sort of plateaued in terms of the number of democracies and the quality of democracy. I'm, you know, in the middle in terms of how optimistic or concerned I am. I see things that are worrying, and it mostly comes down to the quality of governance in countries. Are democratic governments able to deliver? Are they able to deal with problems of corruption and entrenched leaders? Are they able to solve their ethnic differences or any kind of social cleavages? Those are worrying signs. And the nativism can be part of all of that. On the positive side, I don't see anything that is going to be a better alternative than an effective democratic society with democratic institutions where legitimacy is seen as something that comes from a democratic process. That's a participatory process with respect for human rights and access to information, transparency and inclusion. There are these anti-democratic models that are developing, and they are showing some success in the short term, but I don't believe that they will have the legitimacy with their own people over time.
What examples come to mind?
Russia and China, clearly. You know, the literature talks about rising authoritarians in Iran and Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. You know, there's a number of places in Africa as well that we see these tendencies, certainly in the Middle East. The number of those is growing, and that's a concern. But I don't think any of them show signs that they are sustainable, those models, over the long run. And if anything, I think they're quite fragile.
So in China, where I lived for many years, I often heard the argument, not just from government officials, why are you Westerners so hung up on elections? You know, there are ways for the government to be responsive to the population without having elections. And anyway, just having an election doesn't mean you're a democracy. All kinds of places can have elections.
I mean, I agree with that. An election does not make a democracy. And if there's other ways that they can prove that they are accountable to the people, that they're delivering to people, they're being responsive to people, that don't allow some kind of role for citizens to select and to, you know, play a role in holding them accountable directly, let's see that model and show it working. I don't see it working in a long-term sustainable way.
Is there an example that you can think of where there's a country that doesn't have elections but is responsive to the population to an extent where people feel like they're living in a relatively fair society?
Nothing comes to mind immediately. The example that I think of that's not really a country, it's more just, you know, traditional societies. You often think of idealized traditional societies where there is stability, there's contentment, and there's, you know, traditional mores and norms that really hold things together. But even there, I'm not an expert in those, and I don't study those, and I can't cite any examples. But my sense is, those are places where there's a different kind of inclusion. There's a different kind of accountability built into those traditional societies. But they may be being, in my own mind, overly glamorized in terms of how they function.
Yeah. When you've been out in the field, I know your initial area of specialization was Latin America.
Right.
especially in Asia, and I'm not sure to what extent this is true in Latin America, there's been this ongoing argument of, you know, this is just Western hegemony. You're trying to foist your values on us. And, you know, democracy is just a code for American hegemony in the world. Have you had conversations like this when you've been out in the field? And how do you respond? How do you engage with that?
That's a really good question. There's several main responses to that. Usually when you hear that kind of argument, it doesn't feel like it's coming from a genuine place. It's usually somebody who's trying to put you off balance or somehow, you know, make an argument that's defending their own interests. But most importantly, I find the vast majority of people that we interact with around the world talk about their human rights from a sense of understanding the value of the human being and human dignity, and that their right to be included and to be part of a system. Almost all of our interactions are with people who are just expressing that very simply and clearly. That's not coming from the West. It's coming from, I think, a sense that people have slowly internalized what has come from the post-war UN era of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the universality of human rights, and that legitimacy comes from a system where there's representation and inclusion and, you know, having everybody really have a stake in the system.
So when the argument is, these are just Western ideas, you say, no, if you were to listen to your own population, you'd find that actually there's a lot of support for these ideas.
These are ideas that, and they come from a global consensus. I mean, it was certainly the post-World War era and the West was dominant, but there was universal buy-in in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the UN system, the treaties that really make up our human rights law framework. That has broad buy-in. You don't hear many governments now saying that they reject international human rights law. They'll start to try to carve away some exceptions, cultural diversity or some kind of religious arguments might be made. But even then, those are still not trying to challenge the centrality of this framework that is accepted broadly around the world, and it really inspires the work we do on elections.
Yeah. So the old Lee Kuan Yew argument that there are Asian values and there are Western values, and Asian values put the whole ahead of the individual.
I mean, I'm sure that if anything, I would think they coexist, that in most people they would identify that there are Asian values, but that doesn't mean that there are not universal values of human rights and human dignity.
So let's go to the region you know best. I mean, you know a lot about a lot of different regions, but where you started, Latin America, how is it doing?
I think Latin America is doing quite well, really. There's a few places where things are quite difficult, but for the continent as a whole, Central America, the Caribbean, and South America, it's actually done very, very well. I mean, as an example of that, in our work here at the Carter Center, a lot of our first missions were focused on Latin America. Very few are now because, you know, the problems have become, they're almost higher level mature democracy problems with a few exceptions. They're about the same kinds of things that, you know, we're struggling with here. There's a lot of campaign finance problems. And that actually is something that is big all around the world. The regulation of money in politics is something that we haven't quite figured out how to do.
Like, given what's happened with Brazil and the impeachment, and, you know, does that concern you that this is sort of setting an example of how someone can subvert the system?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it certainly is concerns me what's happening in Brazil. And I almost think there might be things that are more gendered going on in terms of the politics and the higher level of maturity of democratic institutions in Brazil compared to, you know, military dictatorship period. You've got to find it interesting that the number of people who had corruption charges against them in the legislature and more serious charges than against the president, that there's something that has to do with gender behind what was happening there.
Do you think that happens a lot? Because, I mean, there are actually quite a few countries now that have had female leaders. Do you find that disproportionately they're the ones who get overthrown or acted against? Or,
you know, in terms of heads of state, more often than not, the women who have been in power, especially in the developing world, have come from powerful families. And so they're somebody's daughter or wife. And so they seem less susceptible to this kind of thing. Whereas president in Brazil, you know, it's a completely different story, a leftist, you know, background, and certainly not the daughter of a former president or a wife or something like that. I think the gendered aspects, though, are more pervasive. at all levels in terms of the chances that women have to become active in the political process, from top to bottom, from the difficulty just to be part of a voting process, to being active in a party, to being able to find the resources to become a candidate. I mean, all across the board, those are huge problems that we haven't really started to deal with effectively. We've gotten a really good understanding of the problem over the last 10 or 20 years as more and more organizations are focusing on that. And we're starting to gather more systematic data, and we're starting to really try to implement better recommendations and tracking, but we have a long way to go.
So let me get down to the nuts and bolts of the electoral process in these different places. Do you see particular patterns, particular problems that are sort of universal in emerging democracies in terms of how the electoral process is subverted? I mean, I've covered a lot of elections in Cambodia, so I know that one well, and Thailand. But in a place where maybe there's resistance from entrenched powers to allowing a democracy to really take root.
There's a lot of different ways. You know, in the old days, it would have been ballot box stuffing, very obvious and direct. And now that's very seldom the case because there's a lot more attention to what happens on election day. There is sometimes changing of results in some higher levels of aggregation, and there's lots of ways to look for that if you're an election observer. I think more commonly now, the way that certain actors might try to affect the process tends to be with including or excluding voters, either on the registration list or with voter identification documents, who's entitled to vote, with the advantages, especially of incumbents, by using state resources in their own campaigning, dispensing of favors, making sure that certain villages or certain parts of the country, receive public works or other things that they can recognize this is coming from the government, making it difficult for the other side to campaign, which we often see a lot of. And other things to do with the financing of elections. Those are really the things that are more prevalent now that are what we're trying to assess.
What about disinformation campaigns, like telling voters who are likely going to vote for the other side that the election's on a different day, or that people who did something can't vote when they can?
We also see misinformation. People are smarter than a lot of elites think, though. This is something that I really firmly believe, and I've seen more and more of that. There's a lot more sophistication these days, even in some of the least developed countries. People will know that somebody's giving them a favor and might expect that a vote is being bought. But they also know that if they're confident that they can go into that ballot box and it's secret, they can take the money and vote their conscience.
Yeah, no, I'm smiling because when I lived in Thailand in the late 80s, early 90s, and would go to the slum Klong Tui in Bangkok, they would take bribes from everybody, and then they'd vote. It was a nice bonus for the month.
Right, and they know that this is part of, people might think that they're buying your vote, but actually you're just getting a lot of t-shirts and a lot of other things because it's election season, and that's part of what happens.
Yeah. So a more positive question, when you're looking at an emerging democracy or a transitional political system, how do you know that it's probably going to be okay? Like it's reached a point where it's kind of working.
Is there a trusted independent election authority that there's not any serious dispute that these are independent people who are doing things fairly? Over time, are we seeing the ability for there to be alternation in power, especially if there's dissatisfaction with a government? Typically, one of the real easy things to see is, was there a change in power from one party to another done peacefully and through an election? At a very high level, that's a good indicator. Is there a sense that there's inclusion and that people really have a stake in a system? And in many of the places that we work, there's underlying identity issues that are involved that are dividing politics. And that's not going to get fixed easily by elections. Those are deeper political culture problems. Elections can sometimes make them worse, or they can lead to institutions that are going to start trying to find ways to bind the parts of the society together. And that's really a question. What do people do when they're in government? More obvious case on the other extreme are there governments that are trying to extend their rule over and over again? And this is one of the biggest problems we're seeing now, these third terms and constitutional changes where various leaders are finding ways to change constitutions and allow themselves to stay in power indefinitely.
Mm. So as I'm listening to you answer that, it strikes me, you guys are involved in much more than just electoral monitoring or helping with running a good election. It's really about the entire process of maintaining a democracy.
Yes, some parts of the Carter Center are doing other longer-term work with access to information or with, you know, working with the justice sector and access to justice. In the democracy program, we look at elections, but we look at them from a very broad lens. And so if we are able to, we like to be working in a country for many, many months before an election and several months afterwards, so that we're really looking at all of these issues. It's not really about election day in most of these places. Sometimes election day is a relatively important part, but in many cases, it's really more of a pre-election set of issues that are important or a post-election set. And so we're really trying to analyze that. For us, it's looking at elections as a snapshot of what is the quality of democracy and democratic institutions and democratic processes in this country. It's like a test. You know, how is democracy working in this country?
Are you always invited in by the government? Or, I mean, how do you gain access? And has anyone ever run you out?
There's been a couple places where we run out might be a good description of what happened. There's a few, but not many. Our standard operating procedure is we only will work where we are confident that all of the major political forces either deliberately and expressly want us there, or at least, you know, welcome our role or accept our role.
As you look at all the places where you've worked, mm-hmm. at various emerging democracies or states in transition, what looks to you most hopeful?
Ghana has been a pretty strong democracy in West Africa. It's facing a very difficult election this time, so mm-hmm. we're trying to keep an eye on it. Liberia is hopeful. It's starting from a place that was so terrible at the end of the Civil War. I mean, it was a complete disaster, and so it's come quite a ways. Tunisia is by far the best example in the Middle East region, Middle East, North Africa, of a place that's really gone through a difficult transition post-Arab Spring and has worked really hard with developing a new constitution. In an area where there's still a lot of government performance issues, economically it's difficult, and the whole, you know, radicalization and violent extremism, and Tunisia being a source of a lot of the disaffected youth. So it's been the most successful, but it still faces a lot of problems. Myanmar and Nepal, two places that we've worked, I'm optimistic about prospects for both of them. Indonesia is a place that really has also done quite well, and a lot of Latin America. So there's examples all over the place. It's just that there's also counterexamples.
So that's countries. What about in terms of technologies or processes? Like, is there anything about online voting or the technologies available to monitor electoral processes mm-hmm. that make it harder to rig an election or easier for more voters to get access? Or is that more of a first world thing?
I think it's unsurprisingly, it's a multi-edged sword in terms of how it's cutting. Certainly the technologies are making inclusion a lot easier if it's being used that way. There's certainly more ability to register voters using, you know, biometric voter registration is a wave that a lot of countries are taking part in. It's a technology that people think is going to fix all their problems because it's coming from a perspective of doubts about the accuracy of the voter registration list and multiple voting. And many times the concerns might be overblown, not always, but it may be seen as a panacea that it really isn't, and coming at an expense and a technology that's really hard to make work and to justify. Internet voting and electronic voting are things that we've spent a lot of time looking into, and certainly the technology is especially important for allowing more participation for disabled persons in particular. But internet voting and electronic voting are potentially problematic in the sense that it's really difficult to have the transparency to know that a vote has been cast by a person with no pressure or coercion on them, and that it's counted accurately. That cluster of problems about a person being able to vote secretly with no coercion and having it counted accurately, the solutions with technology are not obvious to me yet. And if anything, they can sometimes make some of these problems more difficult.
And also, are there any countries besides certain states in the United States that don't have a paper record of votes?
Let's see, most of the places that have electronic voting that come to mind have a paper record. The way we understand it, if you don't have a paper record, you're really inviting a lot of problems. Even if there's a perfect technology, you want to be able to show people who doubt and don't have confidence in the system that there's a way to check the actual vote on paper. I can't think of an example where they're not using a paper record.
Certain states in the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
So democracy has to work, but it also has to be seen to work.
It has to be seen to work, and there has to be confidence in the process, the institutions, and transparency is going to lead to that confidence. People want to know themselves that there's another check.
So we talked about the emerging democracies that you think look hopeful. They look like they're on the right track. Where are you most concerned about?
The number of countries where there are these entrenched regimes that just aren't really letting go is a big concern to the election observation community. And we don't really seem to have a good way to have an impact on that. You know, there's a number of places, mostly in Africa, but other places where they're changing constitutions to stay in power, and in Latin America, and in several places in Asia where democratization hasn't really opened up. Again, the role of money and the lack of good recognized standards for how to regulate money in politics is maybe one of the biggest problems. We've spent a lot of time at the Carter Center trying to build consensus on what does it mean to say international standards? Because when you hear that in your mind, you conjures up, there's this book that you can pull off the shelf and we'll have all the standards. And it's actually a lot more complicated than that. It really comes from an acceptance of international human rights law in UN treaties and in regional treaties, and in the jurisprudence that comes out of those treaties. And most of the key issues that we monitor and assess have some kind of benchmarks attached to them. Campaign finance is one that really doesn't have much established.
How many countries has the Carter Center been working in on the democracy side over the past year?
Over the past year?
Yeah.
These are not all election projects, but we're working. We have very big programs in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Tunisia, some work in Myanmar and Nepal. We just observed elections in Zambia recently, and also in the Philippines earlier in the year. A number of programs here work in Palestine, Colombia. Well, not the democracy program, but there is also a large effort in Colombia.
Have people been asking what the heck is going on with you guys?
Yes. People have asked us about what's going on with the United States for a long time, ever since the 2000 election. When we go to a country, they'll talk about Bush versus Gore and the 2000 election and, you know, the problems in our own country. We've never said the United States is a really good example for you to be, you know, modeling your country after, in part because there's not a country like the United States that I can think of that has such an extremely decentralized system where elections really are governed at the state level. There's a lot of autonomy. It's really a state-level function. In some states, it's extremely decentralized to the county level. Part of our political history and the process that led to the creation of the United States has resulted in this extremely decentralized system that is not good for organizing a system that is coherent and fair across the board and with consistent processes. It's almost the exact opposite.
That's a system that we've had for a long time.
Right.
But this year in particular, I think a lot of people around the world are paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a system that really forces you into a two-party choice, which is actually something we hardly ever see where we work. And the way that our system has led to two such unpopular candidates running against each other, with the polarization in this country and the lack of a central election administration that can really ensure that there's a consistent level of preparations for elections, integrity to elections, I think that it feeds into the sense that there's a lack of confidence.
Do you get the sense from people you're talking to in these other countries or that your staff are talking to that they're starting to feel like we're setting a negative example?
Everybody around the world watches the United States and watches the United States elections. I'm sure you've experienced this in far-flung villages. People will know about things that happen in the United States. I think this campaign, unfortunately, is just, this is not an example to emulate.
Is there an example to emulate when you're saying our system isn't one? I mean, let's put the past year aside. Yeah. In general, when you say that our system isn't one that people should necessarily copy, is there a democracy out there where you're like, yes, this would be a good model for a lot of developing countries?
There's no perfect example. There really isn't. There's a lot of good practices in a lot of different places. And it's not all bad in terms of the United States. There's actually quite a number of things that we point to in the United States that, you know, until recently, we could really say the United States is a good example in the sense that people have trusted our institutions here. And the fact that in the 2000 election, in a very close election that came down to a couple of hundred votes, two parties, really tight competition, a good case to be made on both sides of this election dispute, and there's a Supreme Court decision and the result is accepted, that's, you know, a lot of countries that would never happen.
Last question. So the podcast is called Whose Century Is It? Yep. You said earlier that the number of democracies has sort of plateaued. Do you think this will be a century in which democracy advances or recedes?
I don't know. I would like to think that it will increase. I'm most optimistic because when we see young people around the world, young people are really aware of their rights and they're more and more engaged, and they want to use technology in a way that helps them be part of the system. And so you have to be hopeful about that. So I guess that's my answer.
I like optimists, especially those whose optimism comes from experience on the ground. So sure, democracy, both at home and in many places around the world, has had a rough ride of late. But are these growing pains on the way to a more pluralistic, multicultural society, or a backlash to a new authoritarian era, with most wealth and power concentrated in the hands of a very few? Hard to know at the moment, and it's easy to just feel exhausted after this long campaign season. But democracy is what you make of it, and voting is just the beginning. There's always the need to stay informed, to think critically, to get involved on issues that matter to you, and to be willing to work through differences. Democracy is what you make of it. And as the century moves forward, we'll see how much people are willing to make it work for them. That's it for this time. You'll find a transcript of this podcast on our webpage, pri.org/century, along with all our previous episodes. We're also on iTunes and most other podcast apps. If you haven't already subscribed, please do. And while you're at iTunes, please leave a review and give us 5 stars. It helps others find the podcast. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And you can send a longer note at whosecentury@gmail.com. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.